This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and let's get right to our week in review. Topping it, the race for governor. Steve Grossman won the Democratic State Convention on the weekend, and then the Democrats debated here at WBUR.
This is not a monarchy. You've got to build a consensus in our society around any dramatic societal change.
Also this week, five New England governors came to Boston to coordinate a regional response to a deadly and growing opioid addiction crisis.
What we're saying as governors is the sky's the limit. Let's figure out how we can treat this as the healthcare crisis that it is.
Plus, after 16 months in a custody battle, Connecticut teenager Justina Pelletier is back with her family.
It is parents and family that know what is best for their children other than government entities or courts.
And they were the Boston Braves, then the Redskins before they moved to Washington. This week, the government canceled the football team's trademark, calling it a slur against Native Americans, putting new pressure on team owner Daniel Snyder.
Daniel Snyder may be the last person in the world to realize this, but it's just a matter of time until he's forced to do the right thing and change the name.
Well, joining us now to talk about these stories and the rest of the week in the news is Jeff Jacoby, columnist for the Boston Globe. Always great to see you, Jeff.
Thank you. Good to be back.
Also with us is Tom Keene. He's a former Boston city councilor who also writes for the Globe. Tom, welcome back to you as well.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So let's dive in with the governor's race first and foremost, because as we mentioned over the past weekend, Steve Grossman came out on top at the Democratic State Convention. Martha Coakley was second and Donald Berwick a surprise third because he was just 1 point behind Coakley. And that set the stage for a debate moderated by our own Bob Oakes. And in that debate, Steve Grossman came out swinging. Here he is, challenging Martha Coakley on gun control.
Why won't you join the governor and accept and support one gun a month? It seems common sense. This is the position the NRA has taken.
I think you've asked the question. Let her answer it.
Yeah, and I guess I don't understand why you don't understand, Steve, because I have worked in this field for a long period of time. I get an F from the NRA on this issue.
So Grossman was aggressive against Donald Berwick as well, not just Martha Coakley, about Berwick's plans for a single-payer health care system in Massachusetts. But on Monday, Donald Berwick joins us here on Radio Boston, and he said this.
I was in living rooms and libraries around the Commonwealth, and the enthusiasm, the embrace of the bold, progressive ideas that I introduced, that I want to introduce into this campaign and have done, people want it. They're ready for this state to really show the rest of the country what it's like to have a progressive agenda successfully carried out for people.
Okay, Tom, so let's start off with you. What's your take on the Democratic field? I mean, Grossman is seen as running an insider's race, but Coakley still leads when it comes to the statewide polls.
Yeah, well, of course, what you're hearing from me really is a yawn, but this is not an
even with all that
race.
Punchy tape you just heard?
No, it's the Gun a Month Club. I love that idea, as if that's really going to solve the problem. I think I'm with the conventional wisdom here. It's going to be Martha Coakley. She's clearly ahead in the polls. Having said that, this is a dull race, except perhaps for Don Berwick. Berwick is a little bit of the outsider, very much the outsider in what's an insider's race here. Could he muster the enthusiasm that Deval Patrick was able to do 8 years ago? It's probably not. But otherwise, I think it's going to be Martha.
Okay. Well, hold that thought on Berwick for a second, because, Jeff, I just want to turn to you with some information about a poll out from the Globe today, which finds us, as Tom said, that 52% of likely Democratic voters back Attorney General Martha Coakley, 19% for Grossman, 9% for Donald Berwick. So as Tom said, it seems that regardless of what the convention said, popular polls still have support behind Coakley.
It's such an old story in Massachusetts politics. I remember some years back writing a column saying if you want to win your party's primary, the first step is to lose your party's convention endorsement. And it's happened, you know, every 2 years or every 4 years on both sides of the aisle. That's not an unknown phenomenon. And when you consider that conventions are a big orgy for party insiders, it's not surprising that they come up with a different reaction.
Insiders and extremists.
Right, the ones who are the diehards, the hardcore, right. The ones who breathe and sleep this stuff 24 hours a day, but those aren't the kind of people who vote.
Well, Tom, on that point, I mean, nevertheless, you heard that because of Berwick's close third place finish, it seems like he's forcing a conversation amongst Grossman and Coakley that otherwise might not have gotten so much play. I mean, they've had to talk about single payer now, even if they don't really want to.
Right, without question. If Berwick wasn't in this race, Grossman could be taking on Martha Coakley very directly. You'd probably see a shift more towards the center. they still now have to go, kind of go to the left a little bit because here's Don Berwick talking about those lefty issues.
Right. So, Jeff, let me ask you, what do you think this all means for the man, the primary guy watching from the GOP side of things, Charlie Baker? He's got a primary race, of course, of his own to deal with. But what do you think, if you're Charlie Baker, what do you make of the Democratic field?
If I'm Charlie Baker, I would love to have Don Berwick be the Democratic nominee, win the primary, because I can't imagine there would be a candidate whose basic policy would be easier for me as a Republican to criticize, and also one that would put the biggest gap between the general electorate and the opponent on the other side. Charlie Baker running against Steve Grossman certainly gives him the opportunity to say, you want to empower Beacon Hill, you want to just keep on having the same old. What was who was it that did, was it when Romney ran and his the thing was the Gang of Three?
Right.
There was already a Democratic governor. There was already a Democratic Speaker of the House. There was right. already Democratic. Do you want to have it all be totally totally deep from one end to the other? Against Martha Coakley, that's presumably Charlie Baker's least preferred candidate. He doesn't get a say in that matter, though.
Well, let's move on to a very different story. It took a dramatic turn this week, the case of Justina Pelletier. She's the Connecticut teen who's been at the center of a legal battle between Massachusetts state officials, doctors, and her family. Justina had been in state-ordered care for what doctors diagnosed as a psychosomatic illness. The family sided with another doctor from Tufts who said the illness was cellular, not psychological. That brought the State Department of Children and Families into it. They sided with the first team of doctors and accused the family of medical child abuse. Then a court on Tuesday overruled the state, sent Justina home to her parents in West Hartford. Here's the family's advisor, the Reverend Patrick Mahoney, who said the case wasn't over for the Pelletier family.
They are committed to ensure that this injustice never happens to another family in America again. That the 16 months, the nightmare, the tragedy, the crying, the weeping, the financial ruin never happens again.
Wow, strong words there. Tom Keene, I'd love to come to you on this. You've seen some of the court writings on this. I mean, there was really a sort of 180 about face, right?
That's right. I mean, this case has been going on now for well over a year. The judge who originally basically gave permanent custody to the Department of Children and Families reversed himself in the decision this week and gave permanent custody back to the Pelletier family. So it is a 180-degree difference. And I think what happened, if you go back and read his original decision, the parents, mom and dad, were kind of just furious about everything, were refusing to cooperate, just were not working with the officials here, and so the judge let them have it. They got the message somehow that what they needed to do is play ball. They participated in family counseling, a whole bunch of other sessions. The judge, I think, really rethought this one. I will tell you personally, I started off really, siding with doctors because I guess we all side with doctors because they're smarter than us. But I am now really thinking that the Pelletiers were right all along, that this was a case where particularly Children's Hospital turns over a rock and just sees child abuse rather and almost automatically makes that assumption. And it clearly was wrong in this case.
The trouble I have with this story is there's so much that we don't know. I mean, there's these charges of medical child abuse. The hospitals involved have their own side of the story, but because of patient confidentiality rules, they're prevented from telling their whole story. So I'm sort of left wondering what's going
right
on here.
I mean,
Jeff, why has this story resonated so widely, particularly in the conservative media?
That's a good question. I have actually wondered about that because as I've listened to a lot of the blowback that it's generated, I find myself wondering how it is that people are so certain. How are they so absolutely convinced that they know which side is right and which side is wrong? I think that there's, in general, a predilection on the right to be suspicious, especially when the government to be skeptical when
right.
the government claims we know better than these parents who seem clearly to love their daughter what's best for her, and when it, as you learn more and more about it, and you find out that there's medical controversy, it's not so clear what the details are, and if medical child abuse is a legitimate phenomenon, if there really is such a thing as psychological mitochondrial disease. I mean, all of it just seemed so murky. And the idea that Judge Johnston would issue that first ruling, which was so harsh against the family, it may be, as Tom says, that the family or the family's advisors told them, you got to clean up your act a little bit just in terms of seeming more cooperative. Mm. That may well be, but I think a lot of what happened between decision one and decision two is that the state of Massachusetts and the judge felt a lot more heat. It was more a case of feeling heat than it was of seeing the light.
But Tom, do you see any wider implications in this case, or is this just one isolated sort of sensational case and story?
I think there's clearly wider implications, and I think if you work for DCF at this point, you have no idea what you're supposed to do, because if you fail to act, all of a sudden there's a dead child and you're criticized for that. If you do act, it's a case where you really shouldn't have acted and you're criticized for that. I do not know, seriously, in terms of running something like Jeff is right. I mean, people approach this with ideological blinkers on, but to a real degree, you have to understand that sometimes there are families who really are bad for their kids, mm-hmm. and you have to take the kids away. And on the other hand, you can't go overboard on it. But where is that line? How do we know? I mean, as you pointed out, we don't really know the information in this. And I think in many respects, the social workers and someone working for the state can't peer into people's minds. So they can't say, are you really a good parent or not? Mm. And therein lies kind of the mystery of how one handles this.
It's also just hard to
real mystery.
I don't think we've thought so much before this case about how medical professionals can also have an agenda of their own, which can come into play and which can affect decisions made by DCF. You know, you look at the front page of the paper today, and so here's DCF, as Tom says, putting far more children into foster care, acting much more vigorously, especially since the death of Jeremiah Oliver. I've thought for the longest time, and my instincts are libertarian, but I've thought for the longest time that this is one where there is no clear libertarian or conservative or liberal guidepost. It's never clear what you do in a case like this.
I agree with that.
Right. Well, let's move on to another health policy story, this one which does affect thousands of New England families for sure. It's the opioid addiction crisis. On Tuesday, New England governors, with the exception of Maine's Paul LePage, met at Brandeis University to discuss regional approaches to battling the burgeoning opioid crisis, prescription drug pills and heroin in particular. Here we have some tape of Connecticut Governor Daniel Malloy, who said that interstate cooperation could help combat so-called doctor shopping across state lines.
I live in Hartford. Hartford is very close to Springfield. It's entirely possible that somebody who is abusing a drug in Hartford would cross the border to Springfield or another community in the Commonwealth to make a purchase.
So, Jeff, just briefly, how do you see this? I mean, a regional approach seems to be a new chapter in the fight against this opioid addiction crisis. Do you think it could be effective?
I don't think it could hurt. There's the old line about the states being the laboratories of democracy, and as one lab, figures out something that works, I don't see anything, nothing strikes me as being wrong with sharing that with other labs that are in the neighborhood. If it's the case that they'll be able to make it easier for people who need treatment in one state but can't find a local center to get treatment across the border, is there anything wrong with that? I'm not sure. I don't, nothing strikes me about it. It doesn't seem like it's very substantive, though, and I don't know that five New England governors getting together and saying, here's some guidelines that we're going to try to do going forward is going to change much, and it certainly doesn't seem to do anything about addressing the cause of this spreading addiction. I'd like to know a lot more about what it is that actually is causing it.
Mm. Well, at least the governors have said that they'll try things like prescription drug tracking and maybe making it easier to get treatment across state lines, things like that are underneath, in their purview of things that they can control. I mean, Tom, what's your take?
Well, the doctor shopping thing is an old story. By the way, there is some irony here that we're now mad at doctors for prescribing opiates while we're also letting them prescribe marijuana. I'll just point that out. There is an irony there. But I think the doctor shopping thing. So you look at what they were saying, well, do a regional approach, and so you can't go from Hartford to Springfield for doctor shopping. I don't know if you actually need a regional approach to be able to solve that problem. If there are doctors who are out there just blithely handing out drugs to people without really looking for the medical indications there, I think we could nail them just as a state without having a regional approach.
Mm. So let's move on finally and touch briefly on an issue that has its origins here in Boston and has a lot of people talking. When the Patriots kick off their 2014 season, they'll travel to Washington, D.C., where they'll play a team with the name of the Redskins. Critics have been calling for a name change for years, and this week the government got involved and ruled that the team's name is a racial slur and thus disqualified from trademark protection. So here's sports columnist Brian Burwell. He grew up in Washington, D.C., a fan of that city's fine NFL team. Here's what he said.
To Native Americans, this word is just as distasteful as the N-word. Just look at the history of the word. There's absolutely no context that you can convince me why this is a good thing. And look, I know it's been there for a long time, but one of the things that we're seeing right now when it comes to gay rights, when it comes to the use of the N-word, that we're an evolving society.
Now, the story has some Boston roots because the name was born here. Once upon a time, the Redskins were the Boston Braves. They switched their name and eventually moved to Washington. But, Jeff, what's your take on this continuing controversy
Hail
that has now gotten a little bigger?
The Redskins.
Okay, Tom, your take.
I know, I think I read Jeff's column on that before.
Oh, man, the whole thing is just so crazy. First of all, the trademark business. I mean, just to talk about the legal issue for a second, it doesn't actually change any of the rights that the Redskins have or the NFL has. You don't lose your rights.
No, it only means that someone else can use it, which is, I thought, the point. We didn't want them to use it.
But it also means it puts Don Snyder under a lot of pressure, right? More pressure?
It may be putting him under pressure, but he seems to be pretty good so far at resisting pressure. But the whole thing is so nonsensical to say that there's absolutely no difference between the word Redskins and the N-word. Nobody could conceive of using the N-word to name anything, and yet there are teams all over the country that have names that are related to Indians, that are related to Redskins. No sports team, I mean, the point's been made over and over and over again. No sports team in the history of sports teams has ever given itself a name that was designed to be insulting or designed to be a smear, designed to be...
Okay, but let me push back, because times do change, and I think we heard that cut from Brian Burwell. I mean, times do change, and what was acceptable 30, 40, 50 years ago might not be acceptable.
The market will tell Donald Snyder when it's time to change the name of his team, or, you know, as long as you don't have... You don't need to have the trademark appeals board coming in and rendering decisions on this thing, especially when the facts haven't changed since the last time it ruled on it, when it ruled exactly the opposite.
Yeah.
Besides, there's a huge First Amendment problem. There are a lot of things that people can be offended by. The First Amendment gives you the right to say things and do things that other people may find offensive. It doesn't give the government the right to squelch it or to penalize people for doing it.
So,
Tom
King,
what's your take?
Jeff's absolutely right on the trademark issue. As a lawyer, if there's one area that I always thought was immune from politics, it was patent and trademark office, and apparently not. This is a pure political
decision.
Maybe
there'll be some hot Admiralty case coming next.
But where I really would part with Jeff is, while I don't think that the N-word and Redskins have exactly the same equivalency at all, quite clearly the term is very offensive at this point. You know, that the team is going to have to change it eventually. Snyder would be smart to do it, but he's going to hang out, it appears. But eventually the name's going to change. We know that.
Yeah. I think that
they want to move back into Washington, D.C., and they've been told flatly they can't come back and get a stadium unless they do.
Okay. Well, as much fun as I've been having listening to this portion of the conversation, before we wrap up our week in review today, we did want to just make a little change to our normal our normal schedule here, because usually at this point in time we have our hubbubs for the week, but we decided that instead that we would want to ask the two of you about a major anniversary that's coming up this weekend, because on Saturday it is the 40th anniversary of the court ruling that began busing in Boston, and we're going to talk in depth about this during the rest of the show. But I just wanted to hear your thoughts about this anniversary from both Jeff and Tom. Jeff, let's just start with you.
I think busing was a disaster. I think the further we get away from it, the more of a disaster it looks like. I think Judge Garrity was a megalomaniac, and he presided over this case in a fashion that did far more harm to the city than any good that it might have done. It certainly didn't solve any of the problems that forced busing was supposed to solve. It didn't make Boston public schools better. It didn't make Boston's public schools more integrated. It didn't it didn't win the support or build more of a community spirit around the schools. It caused a lot of violence, a lot of dissension. It drove tens of thousands of parents or the parents of tens of thousands of kids to take their children
out of the
school system or out of the city entirely. Just in every way, it was a disaster, and it never dealt with the real problem, which was the lousy quality of most Boston schools in those days, whether attended primarily by black students or by white students. Focusing on shoving kids together was the worst possible approach, and yet that's the one that Judge Garrity insisted on and never relented on. Years later, he was still saying he wouldn't have done anything differently if he had a chance to do it all over.
Right. We heard someone this morning say that it was a mathematical solution to what was essentially a social and educational problem. Tom, your thoughts?
Look, it was kind of the law of unintended consequences. You put in place a solution and actually backfires and probably exacerbated a situation. Having said that, the court case was exactly right. The school committee was deliberately segregating. They were deliberately depriving Black and African-American communities of resources versus white communities. They were drawing lines that they shouldn't have been drawing. And to that extent, the decision was kind of a wake-up call that forced Boston to grapple with this. Unfortunately, the solution backfired completely. I also have to tell you that part of the real issue here, of course, is not kids failing to go to school together, but rather neighborhoods themselves and housing patterns that are segregated, which is a far deeper problem and one that persists in America.
Deeper indeed. Well, we're going to be talking a lot more about this 40th anniversary for the rest of the hour, as Magna said. Tom Keene, former Boston City Councilor, he writes for the Boston Globe. Thanks so much for coming in.
Pleasure.
Really good to have you. Have a great weekend. And Jeff Jacoby, columnist for the Boston Globe. Always a pleasure to see you. Thanks for coming
in. Great to be with you guys. Thank you.
Well, stay with us. There's more of the show in just a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.